lost in the fog of a cosmic storm. Floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight.
Welcome back to Whimsical Wavelengths. Just a note at the top of the show, I'll give away a shirt at the beginning of the next episode. To enter, send an email with a suggestion for a future episode. Just do it. Not to mention, you get a pretty nice spiffy t-shirt. Today's episode continues the Dino-Mite conversation with Dr. Francois Theron, the curator of dinosaur paleoecology at the Royal Tyrrell Museum. Personally, I would not skip part one if this is your introduction to Whimsical Wavelengths, as this episode picks up the conversation just as it pivots to his research in a recent skeleton pulled up of an adolescent Gorgosaurus libratus. Hey, why did the Gorgosaurus eat the lamp? It's because he wanted a light snack. You laugh now, but the skeletal remains of dinosaurs don't find it humorous. Yes, nothing will triceratop these puns. Okay, let's just get to it, shall we? Let's jump in.
All right, well, that brings us perfectly into using the fossils and some of the work that you've done to interpret behaviors of these creatures. So in 2023, in Scientific Advances, you published a paper with some co-authors titled "Exceptionally Preserved Stomach Contents of Young Tyrannosaurid Reveal an Ontogenetic Dietary Shift in an Iconic Extinct Predator." So this kind of brings everything we've been discussing hopefully into sharper focus. It's starring someone we've already introduced, the Gorgosaurus libratus. So who was this specimen?
Well, that specimen is actually a skeleton of a young Gorgosaurus, a young tyrannosaur. It's actually the most complete skeleton of a young tyrannosaur ever discovered in North America. So on its own, it was really a great specimen. We're really happy. But then during preparation, so this means when the skeleton is brought to the museum, the block, the plaster jacket and the block is open and are open, and then a technician starts removing the rock with fine tools. As he starts scratching the rock around the stomach, the belly of the young Gorgosaurus, he discovered tiny, tiny little knuckle bones that were actually coming out of the rib cage. And those bones were tiny, like almost microscopic, way too small to belong to the Gorgosaurus. And we could see them coming out from behind the ribs, from inside the rib cage, poking out. So we knew that we were dealing with something preserved inside the stomach. So we decided to flip the specimen over and prepare it from the other side, clean it from the other side to see what was inside the rib cage. And that's when we saw we found the remains of two small meat-eating dinosaur or theropods called Cetipes. That's the name of the genus. And it's a really small species of meat-eating dinosaur. We're talking like maybe at adult size, probably would have been 2.5 meters long. So it's very small. Our Gorgosaurus was about 4.5-5 meters long. So a much smaller species found inside the stomach. And then curiously, we only found the legs of those Cetipes dinosaurs. They were fully connected together, what we call articulated, but we only had the hind legs of the two individuals. So it's clearly told us that, one, that Gorgosaurus loved chicken thighs, basically, and ate only the legs. But what we saw is that, yeah, they were focusing mostly on the legs of those dinosaurs, probably the meatiest part of the carcass. And they just basically dissected the leg of the carcass, swallowed the legs whole, and then left the rest of the carcass out, probably because these animals were feathered. So maybe there was too much fluff covering the carcass. Maybe there wasn't enough to eat, enough flesh. So just focusing on the meatiest or the fleshiest part of the carcass was good enough for them, dissecting it out with its sharp blade-like teeth, and then swallow them. So it clearly showed us that this animal was, the tyrannosaur, we estimated, was between 5 and 7 years old, the individuals that it fed upon, the city pest individuals, were not even a year old. So it really gave us a rare glimpse at the diet of very young tyrannosaurs before they reach that 11 years of age where they do the transition to start eating large herbivores. Then it clearly showed us that young tyrannosaurs went after small prey, small dinosaur species, young dinosaurs, like young of the years, what we call yearlings, and just chose the meatiest part of the carcass without crushing the bones. So that's quite unlike what we see in adults, where they go after the big plant eaters, they crush through bones that they probably bit and held onto the animals. So it's a totally different feeding strategy that young tyrannosaurs had relative to their adult counterparts.
Yeah, I find some of that surprising, though, because if you've got a, pulling from the paper itself, 335 or almost 740 pound animal, I mean, to forego eating your whole kill must say something about the food availability at the time, right?
Absolutely. And it shows, and the fact that basically it ate those two small city pests in close succession, we estimated that it ate those two animals within a week. Well, the two animals were eaten just maybe a couple of days apart at most, and they were eaten within a week before the Gorgosaurus died. So it's clearly showing that this animal first really liked the taste of city pest, because it went after it twice and ate the legs, both legs of each animal each time. But it's telling us that these small animals must have been extremely common in the landscape for the tyrannosaur to be able to capture two in a row, basically, to eat. And that's something we know about that group of that clade, to go back to the terms we used before, that clade of dinosaurs, what we call caenognathids, to which Cetipes belongs. We know from nests that have been discovered in Asia, but also some here in North America, that they laid a huge amount of eggs, up to 30 eggs per nest. So this means that they probably, when they hatched, they would have been baby caenognathids everywhere on the landscape. So it was probably maybe a seasonal treat that basically was the reproduction season and there were lots of babies around. So the small Gorgosaurus could just basically go crazy and basically start chasing those little dinosaurs because they were so common on the landscape. And that way they could avoid having to tackle large herbivores that were way bigger than them. Large herbivores often live in herds. So the babies travel with the adults. So it's hard to pull out a small baby and feed on it when it's protected by a herd of big animals. Lots of them have ornamentations like horns that could be used for defense.
So the seasonality of what they're eating, the hind legs, might be more akin to, say, on the West Coast when we have a salmon run.
Yes. Yeah, it's quite possible that, it goes with the reproduction season. That there's some events that, because we have no idea if there was, if they reproduced once a year, several times a year, because the climate was really different. There was no strong winter in those days. So that's why we don't know, could they have had several reproductive periods during the season? So presuming there was only one, maybe there were lots of babies at only once a year, and then they had to feed on those babies as they grew all the way to yearlings and into adulthood.
It was at this point in the interview that we had some technical difficulties. And so I attempt to pick up the conversation again as smoothly as it dropped out. I'll let you be the judge on whether or not it's disjointed or not. Just in case you were wondering, that's what happened.
So we just finished talking about where perhaps these smaller dinosaurs are going through a hatch, different than salmon, because that's like a die-off in some respects, but they're plentiful for whatever reason. So that way, food is plentiful enough that in this case, the Gorgosaurus could choose just to eat the meatiest part because there's easy food and it doesn't need to eat the whole thing.
Exactly, because there's so much of those animals going around that basically, as you said, yeah, there's a brood, and actually there's going to be several, as each animal, yeah, laying up to 30 eggs, basically will produce, yeah, a huge amount of offspring. So yeah, there's plenty of food for those young tyrannosaurs.
Before we kind of go a little bit further, this new famous specimen, any idea how it died?
No, that's a mystery. We know it died, yeah, a week after it ate the last little dinosaur. But because of that, we don't know. We know it's been found in a river deposit, probably near the shore, because it's basically a part of the carcass was open back in the Cretaceous before we discovered it in 2009. So we know it could have died during a flood, or it could have died of indigestion. I have no idea. Basically, yeah, we have no idea what's the cause of death for that tyrannosaur, unfortunately. We know what's the cause of death of the little city pest in the stomach, but we don't know yet of the predator.
Right. Okay, so we have these tyrannosaurs that went through some really big changes throughout their lives, and they created, or I shouldn't say created, they filled different ecological niches. So they weren't just the apex predator, they were also filling different parts all the way up. Was there any competition with them at these other stages in their life when they were filling these other niches?
Yeah, that's peculiar about tyrannosaurs. They're, at least in North America, they're in a unique position where they are the only one predators are really small. We have the raptors, like Velociraptor is actually much smaller than what you see in the Jurassic Park movies. It's only like a meter at the hip, so it's not very tall, and it's 2.5-3 meters long. So those are the only other predators at the time, and in North America at the time Gorgosaurus was around. All the other ecological niches higher up are occupied by Gorgosaurus, but just at different growth stages. So that's different if you go to Asia, where you have the big top predators, Tarbosaurus, but there's a few medium-sized predators. There's another type of tyrannosaurid called the Pinocchio Rex. They are tyrannosaurids, but they have a super long snout. And then there's some dromaeosaurs or some raptors that are fairly big. We're talking about 6 meters in length. But after that, you fall down in a small predator zone. If you go elsewhere in the world, or if you go back in time to the Jurassic, then it's different. You have lots of big predators, you have lots of medium-sized predators, you have lots of small-sized predators. So the ecosystems are, at least in North America at the end of the Cretaceous, are structured totally differently. And that's a mystery why that's the case. We think that in part it could be because, well, as I mentioned earlier, early tyrannosaurs were really small animals. They occupied the small to medium predator niche. And then sometime around 100 million years ago, the top predators disappeared, and that left a vacant space for tyrannosaurs to invade and become the top predators. But they never gave up. They didn't forget where they came from. They never abandoned their original niche. They just occupied it as juveniles, as young animals, and just extended their growth to occupy the top predator niche as adults. And that's not what we see in other ecosystems. And we don't really know why tyrannosaurs here in North America did it differently. So it's a mystery. Lots of people are interested in that question, but we'll need yet more research on that topic. Why are tyrannosaur-dominated ecosystems so different here in North America than ecosystems dominated by other theropods elsewhere in the world and earlier in time?
Cool. Well, now pivoting to today, is there any other analogs, modern analogs, where you have creature, animal, whatever, that can take on different niches as it grows?
No, that's the thing that's peculiar. Even if you look in at the mammalian, well, it's mostly going to be mammals that occupy the ecological niches. And if you look at the Serengeti, where you have to look at environments where humans are not interfering, because otherwise, yes, you'd say that we are dominating everything and there's no big predators, but we have an advantage of big brains, weapons, and guns. So that helps us to occupy the top niche. But if you go to the Serengeti, you'll have lions, you'll have leopards, you'll have cheetahs, you'll have hyenas, African hunting dogs. You have lots of intermediate predators at different sizes. So yeah, there's nothing quite like the ecosystems of dominated by tyrannosaurs of North America today. So that's why it's so perplexing. What is going on? Why is it so different? And we used to say that Asia is similar, like with Tarbosaurus being the big Tyrannosaurus. But the truth is, if you look at Asia, there's actually some, not many, but there are some middle-sized predators that are not Tarbosaurus. So even the ecosystems of Asia are different from those of North America. So we don't know what was in the water in North America, but definitely there's something going on.
See, I knew there was a reason why we were special.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I don't know. We got interrupted a few times there, so I don't know if there's anything that I missed asking questions. Is there anything you want to add from that before we pivot towards a look a little bit more wider into the future?
No, I think we probably covered everything. Tyrannosaurs are awesome. They're unlike anything else. And basically they change a lot during their lives, and they're unique. So I think that probably summarizes it.
Awesome. Okay, so we talked a little bit about what we sort of understood at the time of, and there's a bit in the intro, which you as a listener would have already heard, and my distinguished guest would have read, because I haven't recorded it quite yet. But looking into the future, like, where is dinosaur paleontology going? Is there avenues of scientific exploration you expect to give us more insight in the future, or that are only just started going? Or is there, like, maybe they're throwing something completely random, muon tomography to look at density of the bones, or I don't know. I'm just throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. So what was the future going to bring to the field?
Yeah, well, there's lots of new technologies that are being used. I'd say in the past 20 years was CT scan technology. Like, first it started with medical CT scanners to actually look at the internal structure of bones or even inside skulls without damaging them, to look at what the shape of the brain was, or to digitize the skull and import that into an engineering software to reconstruct the skull as a structure and apply loads on them to see how, and apply reconstruct muscles or see to see how powerful their bite was or what kind of diet they could have had. So those are, it's basically application of new technologies. We're kind of lagging behind, maybe because we're dealing with old fossils, and it's still very much a descriptive study. You find fossils and you apply them, but you describe them. But now, yeah, there's more new techniques that are applied for them. The newest one was synchrotron, which is basically using a particle accelerator to shoot a beam at the fossils. And you can get the same results as X-ray, as CT scanners, just much higher resolution. But you can also now map the chemical composition of fossils, and sometimes that can give you information about the preservation style of dinosaurs, maybe even eventually give us information about the color of some dinosaurs when we're dealing with skin impression or feather impressions. Can look at the pigments that are preserved on those structures, and that gives you that allows you to reconstruct the color of dinosaurs. But I think, yeah, the big next step will be application of artificial intelligence. It's not, as I said, yeah, we're lagging behind. It's just starting, and mostly it started for application of huge databases and basically try to sort out and analyze complex and huge databases to try to make sense out of them. There's some deep learning also that's being applied to those databases. But now we're also using artificial intelligence to simplify the steps that were used for CT scanning or synchrotron. Because what you used to do is basically you get slices through a fossil, and then you have to go image by image, select what is bone or select what's empty space, and then you do a 3D virtual rendering of your fossil, and that's time consuming. So now artificial intelligence can be used to actually do that for you, because basically it's time consuming, but it's also extremely boring. So with the artificial intelligence, if that the computer can do that for you, it speeds up the process, and you can, yes, save your brain power for something that's more interesting, like trying to make sense of the results. See, what does it mean for the life, the behavior of these animals? So I think, yeah, that's going to be the bigger steps. Well, of course, there's always the fortuitous new discovery that's amazing and will change our world, but those are far in between. But I think, yeah, in terms of progression of the science, I think it's going to be artificial intelligence that will start becoming way more prevalent in the field, and we'll find new applications to analyze data.
Just the picking of the outlines of individual bones from CT scans sounds so reminiscent of all the other tedium that must exist in every single science. I remember being in the PhD and picking by hand crystals that are about, what are they, a couple millimeters in size, using a microscope and tweezers, and hours upon hours just staring into the lights. So anyone who loves science as much as we do, you also have to be prepared for the tedium that comes with it from time to time.
Oh yeah, lots of people, that's the thing, when or lots of people quit the field of paleontology because what they know of paleontology is what they see in documentaries or on TV. They say, wow, it's fun. You see those guys talking about stuff. Yeah, but that's like the tip of the iceberg. It's 1% of your real work. Your work is most of the time spent staring at fossils, trying to make sense of data. And sometimes, yeah, most of the times it's really boring. So basically, that's most of the research. Yeah, what you see on TV, that's not real science. It's actually the popularization, dissemination of results to the public. But basically, the hardcore science is basically long and tedious. It requires patience, perseverance, and definitely, yeah, it's. If you count how much we get paid per hour that we spend registering data, you see we're probably getting paid less than minimum wage. It can be time consuming and tedious.
You know,
not at all to discourage anyone.
Absolutely not. That is the perfect
included, but just realize that it's not what you see on TV.
Absolutely, and that's the perfect segue because I mean. That right there is the reason my 5-year-old brain at the time when I got to go, I think it was probably 6 actually, but something like that, when I went to the Royal Tyrrell Museum and understood, because I got to see how they took bones out of the ground, I was like, oh my God, I cannot do this. And that's how I ended up being a volcanologist.
Most paleontologists, yeah, they don't do like the fine work of cleaning fossils. I don't have the patience for that. We have instead technicians. For them, they love puzzles and they are patient. So they love digging that. They don't want to do research. It's too complicated, too long. What they want is just clean fossils. So that's why it's totally different jobs. Me, I'd be a terrible preparator because I wouldn't have the patience. I wanted to know what it is right away, expose it, and that would destroy the fossil. Instead, you have to proceed really slowly and patiently. And that's why... we have technicians that do that work. So just because, yeah, you saw the work of people, yeah, cleaning fossils and picking that, so I couldn't do that. Yeah, I can't either. So we're on the same
It just goes there. To show, I think, importantly, that it does take a team of different people with different skills. They're not all of us are wanting to rip it apart and It takes all kinds to make this work.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But for the Royal Tyrrell Museum itself, I mean, I just can't miss the opportunity to give its praise because it is absolutely awesome. And perhaps Bress heard directly from you. What is the Royal Tyrrell Museum?
Well, the Royal Tyrrell Museum is one of the largest museums dedicated to paleontology in the world. I think there's one in China that's owned by a billionaire who bought lots of fossils from China and made it his personal collection. So they're bigger than us, but I think in terms of museum dedicated to paleontology, we're one of the biggest ones. We're located right in the middle of the Badlands in the South Central Alberta. So yeah, from my office, I just look outside and I see the Badlands and I can just walk out of the building and go looking for fossils right there. So it's a great place to work. And we have lots of public galleries that give a little bit of an overview on the science of paleontology, featuring real fossils and some that are replicas or casts that we call. And then after that, you kind of do a little bit of time traveling. You start back at the early years of Earth, back in the Precambrian, and you do travel through time and you walk through the Paleozoic, Mesozoic, Cenozoic, and you see fossils as you walk through the museum. You're going forward in time, getting closer and closer to today, and you see fossils of animals that lived at different time periods throughout the Earth's history.
Absolutely, and it's great. But I really need to know, what is your favorite fossil or exhibit in the museum? And are there any annual events that the museum does or that happens nearby? Which is your favorite and why?
Okay. In terms of favorite specimens, none of them are on display, but they will be on display next year, because next year we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the museum. So there was going to be a special exhibit featuring some of showcasing some of the best specimens ever found. So one of them will be the young Gorgosaurus with the stomach content, will go on display. And the other one will be large ostrich mimic dinosaurs that preserves impressions left by feathers on the forearm that indicate that this animal had a big wing.
Wow.
On it, even though we call them ostrich mimic dinosaurs, they're not related to birds. They're far related. So they did not give rise to birds or ostriches. It's an example of what we call parallel evolution. They basically converge on similar morphology, similar shape. So that specimen is also one that I described back in 2012 that showed evidence that these dinosaurs were feathered and had the wings, even though they could not fly. So those two specimens will be featured next year. I think it's supposed to open for a May long weekend in 2025.
Wicked. And as far as annual events go, are there any?
Oh, yes. Well, we have a summer camp for kids.
What?
Every summer, we take...
You're kidding.
No, I'm serious.
Is it like a Miracle Wish program? Because I mean, like, every kid wants to do that.
Well, we do those too. But I mean, no, it's for kids that can... we have two camps. We have junior camps, senior camps. I think juniors are from... Is it 10 to 13, I think. And then the senior camp, which is 14 to 16, I think. They come for a week, stay in teepees or tents. And then they go and venture in the Badlands for fossils. And 2 days during that week, I take them to two of my dig sites. And then we go looking for fossils. One site, we go looking for microvertebrate fossils. So dinosaur teeth, claws, fish scales, crocodile teeth. And then the other side, we go at a dig site where we actually dig a hadrosaur skeleton out of the ground with tools and brushes and dental picks and whatnot. So, and then the rest of this week, they do different activities related to paleontology. So those are annual events. Otherwise, I think those are probably the most interesting ones. Otherwise, the busiest season is the summer. So from May long weekend till Labor Day, there's lots and lots of activities, guided tours and whatnot, activities outside, indoors, fossil casting, so making replicas of real fossils that you can paint and bring home. So there's lots of activities like that that are offered at the museum.
All right. And really, listeners, if you get the chance, you really need to check it out. If you are listening to this podcast, I mean, it's the place for you. Now, for a listener that I know in real life, he wants to know something. Basically, he's like, what's up with Spinosaurus? And I know we could probably spend an entire episode just talking about Spinosaurus, especially now that we've done all the background, so you can really get into some of the nitty-gritty. But we don't have too much. But why does the thinking around this dinosaur change so much over time?
Well, Spinosaurus is a big mess, if you ask me. I don't want to make enemies for any of your listeners that may be in the field and want to know, but I think what our current perception, the modern perception of Spinosaurus that came out in the past 10 years, I think it's a chimera. It's basically mixed up. It's basically a lot of... How can I put it politely? It's a lot of imagination, because originally the original specimen of Spinosaurus was discovered before World War II by a German researcher who discovered the sail and the lower jaw. So we discovered that in Northern Africa. Not sure. I can't remember it was in Egypt. So we brought it back to Berlin, kept it there. Unfortunately, the specimen was destroyed during World War II. So we were left just with the original description and illustrations of the specimen, photos and drawings of the specimen. So there was a lot of unknowns. There's very few fossils of Spinosaurus are extremely rare. The most impressive one was just the snout, the tip of the snout, that was a form of very big animal. And from that, some scientists started speculating, to put it politely, what could have been the real size. We knew that Spinosaurus was a big theropod, but basically now with that big snout, they start postulating, with nothing else known from the animal or the skull, they started making claims that it came from an animal that was between 16 and 18 meters long. So back in 2007, a colleague and I published a rebuttal. We basically compiled lots of data for different meat-eating dinosaurs, different theropods, found a regression or a trend that could explain how you can predict body size from the length of the skull. And we applied it to Spinosaurus based on the snout. And we showed that, okay, we only have the snout. We need a complete skull. So we looked at other Spinosaurs of the group that looked like Spinosaurus. Other Spinosaurs that had more complete skulls, try to infer how big the skull for the snout would be. And then we brought down the size estimate to 13 to 15 meters, which is still big, but shorter than 16 to 18. And even then we said, our skull reconstruction is still unknown, because basically we don't have the back of the skull for any Spinosaurus. So we just need to shorten the skull by 10%. And we're down to an animal that's the size of T-Rex, which is basically that is a common size for big theropods. 12 to 13 meters in length is basically the size of all big theropods. So we said it's quite likely that Spinosaurus was no bigger than a T-Rex. But the initial authors didn't like that. So they went with the 15 meters that we said could be the maximum based on our reconstruction. And then they found new specimens more recently, I think in the past 15 years ago or something, maybe 20 years ago, they found a specimen. But the specimen is of a juvenile. It's not of an adult. And basically, they only have the hips, the sail, and I think the tail. So then from that, they scaled up the Spinosaurus to a 15-meter-long animal that they had postulated based on the snout, and took pieces from different fossils isolated that they presume is from Spinosaurus, and then reconstructed that big animal that's 15 meters long, almost quadrupedal, and that's fully aquatic. So it's totally mixing different things that are not related, and that come back to this, the length of that snout, basically what size of animal it would be. And I think that 15 meters is too long. It's probably the same size as T-Rex. And also reconstructing it as an aquatic predator. Well, there's no doubt Spinosaurus was an animal that spent a lot of time in the water because its bones, its limb bones are becoming solid to be solidly anchored at the bottom of the water. So it probably spent water, could go down to the hips or in the water. But an animal that's 13 to 15 meters long with a big sail on its back, that would be a rapid swimmer. I don't see that happening. It's definitely an animal that's eating fish and spent lots of water, lots of time by the side of the water or in the water, just capturing big fish, because some fish from there are up to 3 meters in length. So we're talking about really big fish. Well, you need big fish to feed an animal that's 13 meters long, but yeah, making it a 15 meter long aquatic predator that's super agile chasing after fish, except for the authors of the study, I don't think any paleontologists really buy that story. And there's lots of articles that have been published that rebuke that and said that actually, yeah, all the lines of evidence point to, yes, an animal that spent time in water, but not a fully aquatic animal, and definitely not a swift and rapid aquatic predator. So, but that's how paleontology works. You get popular and big stories. The media love big flashy stories and claims, and that's why now we're stuck with Spinosaurus being the way it is today. But I don't think many paleontologists believe the reconstructions we have today.
Just to be fair, I really didn't know any of this controversy before was told to ask you this question. And clearly you were the right person to ask. So that's
the same goes if you remember Jurassic Park 3. There's a fight between Spinosaurus and T-Rex.
Yeah, and T-Rex lost.
Yeah, T-Rex lost. Spinosaurus just snapped its neck. Well, I've studied a close resin of T-Rex, and its bite force, remember when I said T-Rex, its bite force was 15 times that of an alligator? That of a Spinosaurus is equal to an alligator. So there's no way it could have basically been able to kill a T-Rex with a such a weak bite. So
yeah.
Its snout is so narrow, so fragile. It's designed for capturing fish, not for going after big animals. So yeah, what you saw in Jurassic Park 3, Spinosaurus killing T-Rex, totally made up. It doesn't pass the test.
Okay, well, I think I've taken more than enough of your time, although I gladly have you back at any moment.
Anytime, if there's a new discovery, I'm happy to talk about it.
Fantastic. I'm going to totally take you up on that. But we've come to the last question. And if I do get you back on, I mean, I guess you could tell the same joke. I guess that's allowed. But I'm still going to ask the question every time. For every guest, what is your favorite science joke?
It's not a paleontology or dinosaur-related joke, because I find they all turn around, Tyrannosaurus Rex, like Rex wrecking something. They all are just like play on words. Instead, I chose a joke that's from the field of physics. So I think it's funny. Hopefully, your listeners think it's funny too. So the story goes like this. Three famous physicists go on a car ride. There's Heisenberg, Schrodinger, and Ohm go on a drive. Heisenberg is driving, and then they're speeding, so they get pulled over by the police. So the police officer comes up and talks to Heisenberg. He says, "Sir, do you know how fast you were going?" So Heisenberg says, "No, but I know exactly where I am." So the police officer says, "Well, you were going 55 in a 35 zone." So Heisenberg throws his hands in the air, exasperated, says, "Well, that's just great. Now I have no idea where I am. I'm totally lost." So the police officer finds that suspicious. Says, "Pop open the trunk. I want to check something." So he goes up in the back, looks in the trunk. Then he says, "Do you guys know you have a dead cat in your trunk?" Then Schrodinger shouts, "Well, we do now, you jerkwad." So the police officer has had it. "Okay, you guys are all under arrest. So he moves towards them, and Ohm resists. Yeah, you kind of need to know the
yeah, you need to know the characters. Or, you know.
My favorite is the response of Schrodinger said, yeah, well, we do now know that there's a dead cat in the trunk.
Well, when somebody asks you to join the resistance, you can just go, Ohm.
Ohm, oh, there you go. Yeah. So that was my joke. Hopefully someone, at least one listener will find it funny.
I did.
You did? Okay.
That's all that really matters. I mean, I'm doing this for me. The more people that listen to it,
the better. As long as you thought it was a good joke. If I get invited again, I'll try to find another joke that maybe a dinosaur related
joke. Or maybe a dinosaur joke. Perfect. Well, thanks for taking the time to do this. And
it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
There. That brings the whole conversation to a close, and I hope you liked it. And remember, of the contest I mentioned at the top of the show, I'm giving away a t-shirt, and all you need to do is find the email in the show notes and send me a suggestion for a future show. And then I'll use a random number generator to pick the winner from whoever sends me an email with a suggestion. Remember, Whimsical Wavelengths is just getting going. So, hit subscribe, tell a friend, leave a rating, and if you're able to, you can also join the Patreon. Or just drop me a line on any of my social media. See you again in 2 weeks' time.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight. In a world so chaotic that misbehaves, melodies that echo show us six always. Colors intertwine, painting the sky. We're lost in the rhythm as the universe flies by. Oh, we're tuned in, feeling the beat of the unknown. Can you hear it? It's echoing through your bones. In this melody.